We sailed on the ship John B., my grandfather and me, around Nassau town we did roam.
Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roerink, Jacob Kanzler, and our special guest, Andrea Beitley from Trescott Rossman, who came not bearing cookies, but bearing bread. Some very tasty rosemary bread that she just took right out of the oven. At a time like this, why bake bread?
It's called stress baking, Kyle. Stress baking. I've also made chocolate chip scones, which were delivered throughout the West Side neighborhood, pasta. I probably am making shortbread cookies later this afternoon. I don't know if I can deliver them to people anymore. This may be the last.
But are you tossing these scones and cookies from 6 feet away?
No, actually, what I did in the neighborhood was I delivered them with my dog on porches and then alerted people to the fact that they were there.
No kidding. You really did that.
Yeah, ask Emily Lawler.
Well, did she respond? Did she respond with cookies of her own?
She did. She made me a cookie with my dog's portrait on it. It's quite adorable. I will tweet it out later today.
I think Emily should make media is essential cookies for everybody in the press corps.
Oh, that's adorable.
That would be great with little newspapers on the front or something like that and cameras.
You're an essential person because you're a member of the media.
Am I feeling essential right now?
I don't to be reaffirmed by this administration that the media is essential after last week we discussed that the media was to blame for the COVID-19 panic.
It's always the media's fault. Well, by now, we're taping after the governor's press event where she talked about the new stay-at-home executive order that she has signed. And obviously, we're making light of the fact that media has been determined to be a critical infrastructure, which I know folks in the media are appreciative of, at least the folks in this office are. But John, what else struck you from watching the governor give this very critical announcement on how to contain the coronavirus and prevent us from getting spikes that will overwhelm our hospitals and our healthcare facilities?
I thought what struck me is the fact that she did it from the ceremonial office in the Capitol building versus doing it from the emergency crisis center in the secondary complex. I think that just undergirds the power of her office, the importance of the order. I mean, it's not that the emergency center is a bad place to do this sort of thing, but it's kind of bright. It's kind of stark. This just looks much more executive, you know, like, you know, the speaks to the sort of the historical power governors have always held and should hold in crisis. So that's what struck me. And she was also very, I thought, careful to follow her script. Very serious about flattening this trend that we've got. And quite frankly, she was pretty brutal in terms of what she sees as possibly coming down the line.
Jacob, your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with John on that. I felt that the tone and the rhetoric in what she said was very serious, a different level of serious. Not that she has been serious before, but just look at what she said. She basically compared us to Italy, in that our numbers are projecting like Italy, which has been held up as the poster child for a country that is overrun by the coronavirus. She shared some projections. I don't know where she got them from, but I'm guessing this is where she's from, her health team, that 70% of Michigan could be infected. That's 7 million people, and that 1 million could be hospitalized. So she shared a lot of sobering statistics that I think help accompany her order about staying home, because the transition now is not from we recommend you stay at home, we order you to stay at home.
Andrew, what were you thinking about?
Well, it's a tough time for all of us, and I think I agree that being in the ceremonial office was a really good tactic, and she definitely stuck to her script. One thing I think is going to be really important going forward, whether you're here in Michigan locally or on the national scene, is not making this any more political than it already is. I'd like to see the governor and anyone else that speaks out about this not just bash the other party, but be truly honest about what we can do together to move this forward. I think this could be a time where we see maybe similar to 9/11, where maybe we start to come together. It's my hope anyway. Could be naive, but I'm hoping.
The other thing I thought she did really well was sort of stressing, especially in the questions afterwards, about what this doesn't do. Because there's a lot of confusion out there. My wife went out this morning to get some groceries for the house, And she said she ran into an elderly woman who was at Horrocks, our local farm market. The woman asked her, what do you think they're going to do with all this produce and when they have to close later today? And my wife said, well, the grocery stores are going to stay open. There's a lot of confusion out there. Everybody's talking about everything from a lockdown to a shelter in place. That's not the language that they used at all. It was stay at home, stay safe. It was much more like, we're making what we have said in the prior week much more official. Yeah. Through this executive order, but it's not martial law. It's far short of that.
And I think it's important that we continue to see the governor out front. I do have a little bit of concern. Today there was reporters in the room, and that made me a little nervous, just knowing that, you know, she's being exposed to people who are out and about in the public. Like, I cringed a little bit when I could hear Pluta and Kathy Gray talking, and this may not be the best thing, and I wonder how much longer we'll see reporters physically being near the governor.
Well, and that was something that they did, what was it, last Friday? I think it was the Friday before last, wasn't it, Jacob? Where we've basically taken a pool mentality with these press conferences, where they only have one print reporter in one of these press conferences, and then some type of radio or maybe TV, and that's it. So you heard Kathy Gray, you heard Rick Pluta, but I don't think that...
I think that was it.
Yeah, and that's just the way it's been, and I think that's the way that it's going to continue to be. My big takeaway was what you mentioned, though, John. Her emphasis of the use of the term stay at home as opposed to shelter in place, because I do think that there is kind of a military... like vibe you get when you hear shelter in place. You just kind of feel like we're under siege, and you're going to have the National Guard rumbling down the road, making sure people are staying in their houses. And that's not what we're talking about here. I think she's just enforcing the type of conduct that I think a lot of people are doing right now anyway, which is staying at home, keeping their distance when they go out in public. They're not going to the malls and hanging around. But I think this is just kind of formalizing the type of personal behavior that we're seeing right now. One thing that was mentioned during this press conference, which I don't think has gotten enough attention, and maybe it will later, is the lack of supplies that we're seeing here as far as testing and gear for the proper medical professionals. Our reporter Mike Malott just called in and said that he has a family member who has pneumonia, is in the hospital right now. They believe he could be exposed to the coronavirus. He should be tested right now, and they just don't have the supplies right now to test him.
Yeah, I mean, what has been the current thread every time the governor speaks out? She has said over and over, we don't have enough tests. I mean, she's been saying it for 2 weeks, and like, I know, you know, governments can move at the speed of whatever they can move at, but this has been what she's been talking about for 2 weeks now. And she gave very specific stats again in this press conference just now about the national stockpile that Michigan was allowed to get. And she said twice to reemphasize that it only covered one shift at a hospital. And so that just kind of helps illustrate for people what we are up against. And again, kind of helps support that argument of like, this is why we're doing this. This is why it's serious. Here's what we have to combat it.
It also goes into future planning. Anyone who's in office now and anybody who plans to run in the future is probably going to have to make this a policy position and something on their policy plan going forward. I mean, who would have thought a year and a half ago when she was elected that we would be dealing with a deadly virus? Mm-hmm. And now we'll see maybe public health reaching a bigger pinnacle in people's communications and policy plans.
She's kind of become a crisis governor, though. I mean, think about what we had last winter with the mm-hmm. was it Consumers gas station or the pumping station that exploded? That situation with the real extreme cold. Now this is 10 times larger, really. I mean, it's really kind of amazing that she's dealt with kind of bigger emergencies than I can remember in quite a few numbers of governor's terms.
And she's about to be presiding over what we can assume to be either a recession or a depression, which will be a very interesting next step here.
Talking about the publics and how they're kind of soaking this in, Marketing Resource Group has just put out some polling that 82% of people are at least somewhat concerned about the coronavirus. And now the coronavirus has gone over roads. It's gone over public health, education as the number one concern that they have in their mind. I was actually surprised from their polling that only 27% ranked it as their top concern. I would think that it would be higher, but maybe if they polled next week, it would be more or higher than 27%.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see the crosstabs and the age demographic breakdown on that, because if they're calling people who are more active in news media and who are pretty addicted to social media, they might have one take, whereas somebody who's going about their day and not reading social media or not reading the news might have a totally different take.
Jacob, were you here when Yanji Wong was our intern?
Do you remember Yanji?
I was, and yes, I do.
Yeah, I know John remembers Yanji. Yanji was our intern back in 2013, 14, I think it was, John?
Right around there, yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Yanji's from China, and she's currently working in Beijing. And she shared some observations with me over the weekend about how China is coming out of this coronavirus outbreak and some of the perceptions that she's seen. Some very interesting comments from her, and I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's pretty lengthy. But she did mention about masks. And that was one thing from watching the coverage over in China and then kind of putting that on to us here in the United States, how they all wear masks and they're just all so used to it. And that here in the United States, she hasn't. So this is what she wrote. As Chinese people are watching closely with global situation, we also found interesting differences in terms of seeing foreigners hoard toilet paper and not to wear masks when going out. Very different from us. We heard from the media that in the West, people only wear masks when they are sick. However, as it has been proved in China, that an infected patient can become a symptom, so chances that healthy people being contracted with virus from these patients are still high. The virus is dangerous, not because one gets infected from people with symptoms, but from people showing no symptoms at all. We also heard ideas from West that no evidence shows that mask wearing can reduce the risk of infection, which doesn't make sense to us. In our minds, wearing masks is both protecting oneself and others. The only reason we can partly understand for people not wearing masks is the shortage of masks for medical workers.
That's one of the things I thought about almost immediately when they started stressing that masks wouldn't help if you don't have the disease. Picture 330 million people running out and buying a box of 3M masks, and all of a sudden there's nothing left, right?
Yeah.
You know, and that's the kind of run we've already seen with toilet paper and with other supplies, and the kind of panic that would ensue if the order was suddenly, we have to be wearing masks, you wouldn't have any for the doctors, we wouldn't have any for the hospitals.
And in Asian countries, predominantly China, they've already been wearing these masks because of pollution that's already in the air. Mm-hmm. And so it's more normal for them. If I were to see Jacob walking in the street with a mask, I would assume he has something going on with him. You might have, you know, the flu or some sort of respiratory ailment. I wouldn't assume he's doing it because, you know, it's gray outside.
And actually, she had mentioned that in her earlier comments to me. She said, in China, maybe it is because we have been getting used to collective arrangements for so long and experienced SARS in 2003. And so it's easier for us. She also mentioned, too, that it's easier for them to comply with orders because they've got a bit of a different governmental structure out there in China. And so they take orders from the government because, well, they kind of have to. She was just talking that they've been doing this for a couple weeks. And, you know, it was interesting to hear from her also that this really hit right before the Chinese New Year for them, which is a huge event for them. It's kind of like our Christmas. And so while the governor shut down our restaurants and bars right before St. Patrick's Day, which is when we usually go and celebrate and woohoo it up, this happened right before they were going to do their Chinese New Year, where she said they spend up to a week in celebrations and go with family and stuff. So it was a real culture change for them, having to resist the urge to do that, you know, not go out and instead self-quarantine herself. And I'm just laughing because there was one line in here that she wrote that to entertain themselves, some of the things that they did. And one person apparently went fishing in his own fishing tank.
That's one way to do it. That's one way to pass the time. I mean, some of us have been doing these mass Zoom happy hours and conference calls. And I know our team this morning had 25 of us all on a big Zoom conference call. And it's nice to just see everyone's face. So people are passing the time in creative ways.
Kyle, the DNR this morning, hot off the press, just announced that trout or fish restocking will not be taking place in certain places in the state. So we could be seeing some fish tank fishing in the near future in Michigan.
Oh, no.
Don't you think you could, you know, with using social distancing, dump a truck of fish into the lake?
That's a great question for DNR, John. Yeah.
Well, perhaps DNR is prioritizing things in different ways.
Well, as a fisherman, I think that's pretty essential service.
Outside of the media and emergency personnel and hospital workers and so forth, people who have been given exemptions under this also include volunteers for the poor and the homeless, with in particular shelters. And sometimes that's not what we think of when we think of situations. We think of ourselves, but there are people who are in worse situations than us.
Yeah, the Michigan Children's Foundation is doing a lot of work around this issue. And we're hearing from counties around the state that food banks need food and they need money because we're seeing record unemployment spiking all of a sudden, and people need food from their food banks. So I know here in Lansing, the Ingham County Food Bank and other area charities are really looking for those donations to come in. And I'm sad to hear that some of our local restaurants are now deciding to completely close their doors. But if you can buy a gift card to any of your favorite restaurants or bars or whatever, help them out while we can still.
Another issue that we're going to have to keep an eye on that we may get some clarity yet today, and today is Monday, but definitely sometime soon, is the May election. And we do have some local school districts and ISDs and maybe even some local units of government that have millage elections that are out that are critical to them being able to operate past July 1. Now we're talking about operating millages for school districts. We're talking about renewing past bonding proposals and assorted other different projects that local governments need to have on this ballot in order to continue operations for certain functions, and they can't put off until August. So the real issue here is to see what happens with that. Now, the governor's executive order powers on this is for 30 days, and we're not 30 days to that May election yet, so an official order may not come until April. But I would expect to see some type of guidance directing clerks to start preparing for some type of absentee ballot-only type of election so that they don't have to open up precincts trying to try to find the workers needed to run these precincts, which would be very hard because, let's face it, most of these precincts are run by folks who are on the older scale, a lot of senior citizens, and the idea of putting them out there for an entire day to run an election will be problematic. And I've already talked with clerks who are concerned about the possibility of trying to recruit those workers, and it's going to be extremely difficult, if not impossible. So I would expect to see something encouraging some type of mail-only election here soon.
Which will be real interesting, too, to see what the impact that has. If we're all staying home and we all get mailed in ballots, how much higher will participation be?
Well, that and what's the mail campaign look like? I mean, we're all going to be sitting at home and seeing all that pre-roll on YouTube and Facebook and constantly getting inundated, but there'll be no handshaking, there'll be no rallies, there'll be no baby kissing for sure in the upcoming elections.
I can tell you what, Jacob, I would not want a new money ask on the May ballot. I don't think that would be the best time. I think I'd pull that.
Yeah, I don't think money asks would be good. But I've also, I'm on a lot of lists for fundraising, and I've received some very, very interesting emails as of late, including one that had a subject line that I would call offensive. You know, a cough won't keep us back kind of situation. I'll show you later. It was a pretty, I was concerned. I was concerned by seeing that.
That's kind of tacky.
It's incredibly tacky. It's incredibly tone deaf and unaware of what's going on in the world around you.
People cannot have a stomach right now for politics when their own personal security is at stake. I mean, it's one thing if you're talking about things that are an arm's length or a world away, you know, whatever. You know, that kind of affects me. Yeah, the roads affect me. They're a nuisance, whatever. But this affects every single person extremely personally. And when you inject politics in it, people don't have the bandwidth or the stomach to deal with it.
No, the only email I want to be seeing from a politician right now is what they're doing to help their community. I don't want to give you $5 when I might need that $5 to feed my family.
Be about the messages they need to communicate to help us all keep each other safe.
Another interesting thing I've noticed in the past week or so is I've seen Gretchen Whitmer and Dana Nessel everywhere. I've seen Nestle's office holding their consumer protection team open. I've seen legislators volunteering to be there. Good for them. I have not seen Secretary Benson out and about. And I'm wondering if she's in the deep planning stages, if her offices are more affected by this because they are so public-facing, or what's going on over at the Secretary of State's office?
Get her to come on the podcast.
I don't know. The invitation's still out there. We'll see if we can get her here in the next few weeks or so. We'll find out. All right, with that, let's get on to our interview. Joining us on the other end of our WebEx app that we're using right now is the former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Homeland Defense Strategy and retired Brigadier General Michael McDaniel. He's an Associate Dean at Western Michigan University, the Cooley Law School, and he's joining us now. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Kyle. Always glad to have a chat with someone about these matters.
Well, this is certainly a unique and historic day with the governor issuing this stay-at-home order. I wanted to get some initial thoughts from you on her taking this pretty big step.
Sure. I guess, first of all, I'm not surprised. This is one of those times where we really need to listen to the scientists, not the politicians. And the epidemiologists in particular have been saying for weeks that we needed to do this. The catchphrase is sort of, let's be like South Korea, not like Italy. And I think, so far, when you see the news footage of college kids and others on the beach in Florida for spring break, we have been kind of acting like Italy, and that's a mistake. So I'm not surprised that she has done this. We have to flatten the curve. I think that when you see the headlines this morning saying, 35,000 cases in the United States, hospitals believe they'll be overwhelmed. Hospitals lack equipment. We got to flatten the curve just so we can spread out the number of cases coming into the hospitals. We've got to be able to keep the hospitals and the hospital workers safe. That's the main focus. And I think staying at home, the act of actually physically distancing ourselves and or undertaking social mitigation is just one way to do that. And it's a necessary way to do that. So that our hospitals in Michigan don't become overwhelmed like they have been elsewhere in the world and elsewhere in the United States, such as New York City.
So Mr. McDaniel has also served under Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm as her Homeland Security Advisor in 2003, served in that capacity until July of 2009. As you've been watching how Governor Whitmer has done in reacting to the coronavirus, what grade would you give her up to this point?
Oh, I'd give her an A. And the reason is, first and foremost, in times of crisis, you want to be totally transparent with folks. And I believe she's done that. She's been on the air, it seems like, every day telling us what's going on. It looks to me like they were designed to ease us into this. There was a very sequential approach to them from the appearance of them overall, which I think makes sense. They've been deliberate and intentional. They have not been reactive. And I think that it evidences a plan. Certainly when I was state Homeland Security Advisor, I worked very closely with the Michigan State Police, who are the emergency management director for the state of Michigan. And we have plans in place for this sort of thing. We specifically looked at pandemic as a potential plan. So everybody from the state HHS, state police, and other, and of course, my own former organization, the National Guard, they all have a plan in place for this. They're all ready to go. And I think we're seeing that in this very orderly and deliberate rollout.
So I'm sure that there are folks who are panicked and extremely concerned about what this step could mean for them, their security down the line, possibly their jobs, their health. What message do you have to the public on how they should be taking this new executive order?
Well, this is not a time for panic. I mean, one of the reasons for this executive order is, as I said, to try and get in front of this. As a nation, we're not in front of this yet. There is a lag in our response. There's a delay in our response, and we're playing a little bit of catch up now. But that doesn't mean there is a reason for panic. The vast majority of these cases are very mild. The reason why we have to approach this as a full-scale pandemic isn't out of fear. It's because that we do not know the period someone can shed the virus. You know, it looks like you can shed this virus for up to 5 or 6 days before you become symptomatic. And some people have very, very mild symptoms and may have the virus and therefore may be contagious to others. So that's the reason to have this order in place, is to assure that we are stepping on this, we are flattening it, and we're going to get ahead of this, both in terms of what we do at home, and what you do at your home affects everyone. It's you know, it's like the opposite of what President George W. Bush told us, you know, right after 9/11, when he said America needs to go shopping. Well, this is the time where America needs to stay at home. It's the opposite message, but it's a really important message. That, of course, goes to your next point, Kyle, and that is the effect that this is going to have on the economy. And that's pretty drastic. There's no question that it's a drastic hit for the economy. That's why we have to have the Congress, if they're going to, you know, there's a almost a default by the federal executive branch to the states. If that be the case, at least let the federal legislative branch, let the Congress come through with an economic stimulus package that makes sense for everyone, including the little guys and the small business owners.
You've commented on Governor Whitmer and her reaction to this coronavirus. How about President Trump? What grade would you give him so far in responding to this coronavirus?
Well, you said thus far. I mean, I'd like to give him an incomplete, but I've got to give him a pretty low grade here. You know, this is... It may be a passing grade because he did stop travel to China early, fairly early. But remember, two things everyone has to understand. We have had a plan in place. This virus may be novel. This virus may be new. But planned our nation's emergency plans for pandemic response, including pandemic respiratory virus response, are in place. When I was at the Pentagon, I worked on the plan for H1N1, and that plan was amended from our plan from SARS, which is a coronavirus fairly similar to this one. We have had a plan in place at Homeland Security and Department of Defense for 2 decades. So we had a plan in place. And secondly, we had the intel. You know, the National Intelligence Estimate for 2019 specifically said a pandemic is a global threat. It was expected. And then on this particular case, we had intelligence from January. We had intelligence from January that was ignored, that said that this particular virus was expected to a pandemic. So we waited too long, and we're playing catch up. As a nation, we're playing catch up, and that's very sad, because we used to be the leader. We used to be proactive, and we need to be.
Now, some have tried to turn this into a bit of a political argument, and I wanted you to respond to that, because one could say, well, look, this guy was an advisor under Granholm, so of course he's going to give Trump a failing grade, or a barely passing grade. You gave him a barely passing grade.
I'm not looking at this politically. No matter who was the president, I would have said that this was a failure of leadership. It is extremely disappointing to me. Let's make sure we're clear of the roles. There is no question that when we are talking about the health and safety of the nation, the governor is preeminent. And our governors, by and large, you know, and not just blue states, but Texas as well, got plenty of states that are stepping up, as they should. The states have the lead, but the purpose of Health and Human Services and CDC through the federal HHS, which controls the strategic national stockpile, and the role of FEMA, the invocation a week ago on the 13th, I think it was, of the Stafford Act. The reason that that was done is so that the federal government is allocating resources from the strategic national stockpile or from industry once the Defense Production Act was invoked, so that you are allocating those resources, those funds, that experience, expertise, personnel from the federal government is being allocated equally as needed to every state. To tell the states, you know, go see what you can get and we'll pay you back. That's not how FEMA is supposed to work. They are supposed to be the controller of those resources to assure that everyone in this country has equal access to those resources. And it's sort of on a per capita, and it's based upon a worst case scenario. It's not saying everybody gets a face mask. is to ensure that they're going to those areas that need them the most. You can't have states fighting one with another, trying to get precious resources or scarce resources.
What is the most undercovered part of this coronavirus, in your opinion right now? What is not being covered enough that you think should be covered much more?
The thing that we're not seeing is we're not able to, because we were so late to the game with testing kits, we're not able to track the spread of this at all. We're not able to do any containment. Some people may think we're still doing containment. Nobody has said we're not, politically or even in the scientific community, but we're not. We are trying to mitigate the effects of this disease, this virus. And then we're going to try and suppress it. We're not doing containment anymore. The reason you're not, the drive up testing kits is really a panacea for people now because we're past that stage. It's too late to try and identify it in certain epicenters and then try and contain it in those areas. We're reacting. So we need to take those test kits now and use them for moderate to severe cases as confirmatory testing based upon moderate to severe symptoms. So that we're just doing confirmatory testing before we're deciding what resources to allocate to individuals. It's too late for containment.
And then on the other side, what part of this whole coronavirus crisis has gotten overcovered or overblown, in your opinion?
Kyle, I guess I don't know. There's an awful lot of media attention on the politics of this. And, you know, it's time for all the politicians to pretty much step back and let the experts go to work here, whether responders or whether the epidemiologists or the public health community. The one thing I think that cannot be overstated is the need of the public health community, doctors, nurses, emergency response folks. We've got to assure that they've got enough PPE. If we start losing that population, then we're going to be really in trouble. Then we're going to have a true nationwide crisis. We're handling it right now, but they've got to have the equipment that they need. They shouldn't be worrying about homemade masks or reusing masks or anything of that sort. That's crazy talk. We have got to use the Defense Production Act, tell the certain industries to assure that they're making the equipment that our health community needs.
There is a lot of conspiracy theories about how this coronavirus started, which I guess is expected in these times. You're smiling, though, and I think that's interesting. Yeah. Because you expect some of this, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Let me analogize back to 9/11 again. Well, some people thought that was created in a studio or it was an inside job by the U.S. government. You know, anytime there's something that seems new, seems unique, seems hard to understand, you know, then there's this rush towards some sort of easy explanation by blaming it on the other or them or the government or some dark forces at work. And it's not the case. You know, as I said, respiratory epidemics are cyclical. This one could be the same scope as 100 years ago with the 1918 flu. That's not something that should be surprising. What's surprising is we have them of such a large scope only 100 years. And every decade or so, we have some form of respiratory epidemic. You know, we had one in the Middle East, called MERS, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome after SARS, also a coronavirus that didn't even get to the United States. The United States has been very lucky, and we should recognize that. But unfortunately, we've always been lucky because we're the United States, you know, we sometimes don't take the protections that we need. We don't have enough stockpile. We did not have the equipment. We do not have enough hospital beds. So we skated.
Michael McDaniel, any closing words here before we let you go?
Just everybody stay healthy and stay calm. There's no reason to panic here. You know, love your family, stay with your family, but stay at home. We can get through this. We're going to see, and I guess secondly, we're going to see a couple waves here. You know, this is going to last 3 or 4 weeks. It's going to subside. There'll be a period of reintegration into society. And there could be a period of reinfection after that. With a new virus such as this, where we have not built up a national immunity to it or a global immunity to it, it's going to take a couple of infections. So there's a second wave. That doesn't mean anybody did anything wrong. If we have, it just means the virus is progressing as they often do. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Michael McDaniel, he is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Homeland Defense, and now currently he's working for Western Michigan University and the Cooley Law School.
And that's going to do for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to John and Jacob and Andrea for coming over here with the bread. And just so you know, I did use the Clorox wipe on this Marantz.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Jacob and I are the most effective social distancers you will ever meet. Go team millennials here.
All right. So with that, thank you to AT&T for sponsoring us and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.